talking about students and learning, everyone has their own journey, but we need to provide them the opportunity to advocate for themselves and to say to us what they need to learn. As we're telling them, everybody's gonna learn in a different pace, and it's gonna happen. I had a friend that called me the other day and said, you know, my son's not reading at grade level. They're thinking of retaining him. I said, let me tell you this. I have 2 master's degrees and I was not reading at grade level in 3rd grade.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Highest Aspirations, an education podcast focused on providing educators with inspiration and strategies to help multilingual learners achieve their highest aspirations. I'm your host, Steve Sofronis. We have 2 great guests today to help us take a deep dive into how implicit bias impacts student expectations and potential, and what we can do to ensure our students have what they need to thrive in school and in their communities. Amy King and Yvonne Williams each have over 20 years of experience in multilingual education in a variety of roles. They currently specialize in providing highly effective professional learning opportunities to help educators in a variety of districts and schools best serve their multilingual learners. You can find their full bios on the show notes and the accompanying blog post on our EL community. Here are some of the questions we'll dig into with Amy and Yvonne. How can we determine the difference between pushing our language learners to productive struggle versus going past their frustration point? What can educators do to intentionally address or decrease the impact that our own implicit bias may have on our expectations for students? How can we support students, particularly multilingual learners, in unlearning low self-esteem or self-confidence for their own learning abilities? As always, you can find a blog post with key takeaways from this Highest Aspirations episode and others on our EL community page. Check out elevationeducation.com/ELcommunity for a searchable library of free multimedia resources that you can use and share right now. We also invite you to join the conversation and learn from colleagues around the country by joining the Elevation Educators Facebook group. There, you'll find valuable tips from others, as well as the connections you need to help you grow professionally. There's also a particular thread dedicated to this episode. Thanks as always for listening to Highest Aspirations, and please enjoy our conversation with Amy King and Yvonne Williams. Yvonne Williams and Amy King, thank you so much for joining us on Highest Aspirations.
Thank you. We are so happy to be here. We know how valuable these podcasts are for teachers, so it's exciting for us as well.
I'm happy to be here too and looking forward to the conversation.
Great. Thanks. Yeah, I hope it's valuable to people who have been doing it for a long time. People seem to like it and want to listen, so we keep doing it, which is fun. And I love doing it as well. And I get the privilege of speaking with folks like you who know so much about this important work. So this is going to be an interesting conversation. There are 2 of you, which I said before we started to record here, that I actually love doing that because you'll bounce ideas off each other. You both just said that you're fairly well in sync and you can finish each other's sentences. So I'm looking forward to that. But Yvonne, I'm actually going to start with you, because when we talked, it seems like it was yesterday, but it was probably like 2 months ago. You talked about your own experience as an English learner and how this kind of shaped some of the work that you're doing now. And I thought it was a really compelling story. It involved your family, your sister. And it really gets at, I think, what some of the problems are in what we're doing, and they're well-intentioned. So I won't tee it up any more than that. Could you kind of take it from there?
Absolutely. I think the reason why this conversation prompted such great thoughts in creating this podcast is because there are many stories like mine, and there are many stories that are still happening today, specifically with the idea of honoring the voices of those who have experienced being in this position, as well as the students that are in current classrooms that are language learners. I was born in Chihuahua, Mexico, and we went to live in El Paso, Texas, which is a border town. And my experience in school really formed who I am today, and in both good and bad ways, right? Because the work that I'm doing today is because of the challenges I had in trying to achieve the same goals as my English speaking peers, and how difficult it was for me to accept being a C student, for example. Mm-hmm. And so when I had my 2 sons, I decided not to speak Spanish to them because I felt that I wanted them to be successful, not realizing what I was doing. And it came from the fact that at some point during my time in trying to find my place in El Paso, Texas, in the US, I thought that speaking Spanish was a bad thing. And I started to connect more to the English language, even though I spent all my summers with my family in Mexico and we were there every week. I didn't find my place. It's known to ni de aquí ni de allá. You're not from here, not from there, because you get it from both ends. And this story, though very unique, because I was born in a time where it was still, you know, there was a lot that happened in schools where you were not allowed to speak Spanish. And we've evolved from that scenario. But there's still that feeling of you're not from here, you're not from there, because you then start to speak Spanish differently. And then English is not your most perfect way of speaking. And I think we've evolved from that. And now we know that there are many ways of communicating and that we need to honor the students. And so the journey is so valuable and so important. And so I think teachers recognizing that every student has an individual journey and that the teachers have a lot of power in communicating what we know today, brain research, that these multilingual, bilingual students are brilliant. And I think that that is why it was so important for me to join the ranks of education. My sisters and I are all in education for that reason. We really wanted to ensure that the message was clear that bilingual and multilingual is actually better than just
monolingual.
Just monolingual. And so I think that that is why this conversation is so important and continues to be an important conversation in education.
Yeah. And thanks for telling that story. I mean, that's, you know, probably not an easy thing to talk about given the sort of relic or the effect that had on you and lasted. It persisted for a long time, and I think despite many of the changes, positive changes that we are seeing, it still persists and it still requires work. And interestingly, I hear that when I speak with people who are on those border towns, more than it seems, and this is just totally qualitative information for me, talking with people, so it's not a research study, but it seems like I'm hearing that more from those communities, which is kind of shocking to me, but I guess it makes sense given what you just said.
Yeah.
So I want to like dive into that a little bit more, because there's like this, I've heard it be called the pobrecito syndrome from many, many people. And it's this idea that we all want to do right by our students. We want to give them the support, right, and the opportunities that will help shape their academic and professional future. But there's that trap where we think that these students can't do this. And if we make them do something that's above where they are, they're going to struggle too much. It's not going to be productive struggle anymore. It's going to be very difficult. How do we, you know, you've talked about this. How do we get past that? And what do you like recommend that we have our educators do, or if you're an educator listening to this now, what is it that you should be doing to kind of avoid that? Because I've certainly, as a teacher myself, I fell into that trap over and over again.
Yeah, I'd say I know too, as a language learner in different environments, you know, feeling that the struggle of trying to communicate this idea that, and for people that don't know, and maybe Yvonne, you can help with my translation, but it sort of means like poor little one. And it encourages us to feel like we need to sort of take care of these kids or kind of coddle them in some way. And for me, I think at a baseline, it's really a mindset shift and a recognition that regardless of proficiency in English, these students are bringing in a wide range of assets. They have lots of experiences, background information. And I think at a minimum, speaking to Yvonne's story, you know, they show the ability to persevere and be resilient in the face of challenges. So I think it's, for me, it just has to do with changing the way we think about the students that are coming in.
And it's so important, because you mentioned, Steve, that you also fell trapped to it. I fell trapped to it because when we're working with a group of students that we know we are trying to empower to learn and acquire a second language, we fall trapped to the idea that we're there to protect them and support them. And it's not something that we see an immediate response to, but as teachers, it's in our hearts to want to teach. And if we don't see it happening in the moment, then we fall into this, we're frustrated because we're trying to do the best that we can. And then do just enough so that we see that they are happy in the progress that they're making, instead of really thinking about what is the potential that we're trying to get them to meet. I had a wonderful experience observing a pre-kinder student from Mexico who was narrating a story, and the language that he used in Spanish was some that I don't even have in my everyday language in Spanish. And even
how so?
Well, you know, it's interesting. He used vocabulary words that I understood in Spanish, but that are not commonly used because it was more the language of school.
Gotcha. So yes, academic language. Yeah.
Or academic in nature. Yeah.
Yeah.
And not only even academic, the way that he narrated was so powerful. So he was using the words, but then he was also, his presence was very confident, and he was in pre-kinder. And I would never have expected that kind of an example of my kindergarten students, because I always would think, you know, they're just learning. We just need them to know the basics, and let's not overdo it and make them feel frustrated or overwhelmed. And yet, if that student that I observed comes to the U.S. and enters a kindergarten classroom, the first thing teachers reach out for is, I have a newcomer, he doesn't speak any English.
Yep.
I'm not sure what to do. And that's the trap that we fall into, yeah. That we don't really know that there's a lot that they can come with. And mind you, we're talking about newcomers or ELLs, these labels that have a variety of students. So there's some that have interrupted schooling. There's some that have a lot of schooling. There's some that come from an indigenous area of their country. There are refugees. So to lump up and say newcomer or ELL, yeah, is the starting place for the mistakes that we're making, because we need to identify who these students are before we place a label on them.
Sure.
And I think that label too comes with certain implications, you know, or we make certain assumptions based on that label without really recognizing the background of the students that are coming.
Definitely. And the general label of ELL or ML or emergent bilingual, like whatever you're using, is a super homogenous, is not a homogenous group.
Exactly.
And then the subgroups, the newcomers and all the other ones, also not homogenous groups. And that's just more evidence, you know, to say that we need to look at students individually. Something you both said different things about sort of what maybe the solution or the problem is to this kind of pobrecito syndrome, to use that expression. Amy, you talked about the idea of a mindset shift. And then Yvonne, you said, you know, as teachers, we get frustrated that the teaching isn't happening right away. I wonder how much of this, and I say this as a parent a little bit because I fall into this trap with my kids, like how much of when students aren't doing what we hope that they could do is a reflection on us. We're thinking we're not doing our jobs the right way, and we need to make sure. I definitely feel that way. I'll totally own it. I feel that way as a parent. Like if my son who's 11, you know, goes to school, thinks he's not matching clothes because he just doesn't care. He just goes. And but that's like a bit of a reflection. I'm being really kind of vulnerable here and open, but that's a reflection on me. And I have to check myself to be like, wait a minute, this is not me. It's about him. Right. And so how much of that do you think is happening in schools? That's a wider zoomed out question, but
I think the answer to that is the individual journey of every learner and how we need to be really thoughtful on everybody has a different pace to learn. And it is a reflection often that we as parents or teachers feel lands on us, but I think how we communicate that with our students or with our own children, that it's the journey does not, it, we shouldn't define it based on one goal, right? Yeah. It should be based on moving towards the direction of the goal. One of the most important pieces, in my opinion, is the self-advocacy of students or self-regulated of learning, where they're able to communicate. My favorite story, and I tell this often, is I have two grown sons now and my husband, and at Christmas, I gave them these wooden puzzles. And I said, I'm going to give you all a prize of $100 if you complete this puzzle the fastest. My oldest son, who has dyslexia, quickly wanted support, quickly advocated for himself and said, can I look at the picture once more? And my husband, who does not like to fail, said, I don't need the $100. I don't want to participate, and just gave up. And the youngest was an overachiever, was like, you all are both cheaters. I'm going to win. I don't need anything. And he spent an hour wanting to make it work without supports. And my oldest was asking consistently for help. And my husband, who's a reflection of the students who, if they don't feel like they're successful, will give up. And I tell teachers, every student has an individual journey. How we communicate ends up the adults that they become. Like my husband he struggled in school. And so he doesn't like to do anything that'll make him look like he's failing. He'd rather not do it. And the one that was dyslexic experienced the ability to advocate for what he needed to learn. And the youngest, who thinks he can do it all, was determined to spend as much time, which is also a conversation that we're not going to have. But I think it's the same scenario when we're talking about students and learning. Everyone has their own journey, but we need to provide them the opportunity to advocate for themselves and to say to us what they need to learn, as we're telling them everybody's going to learn in a different pace and it's going to happen. I had a friend that called me the other day and said, you know, my son's not reading at grade level. They're thinking of retaining him. I said, let me tell you this. I have 2 master's degrees and I was not reading at grade level in 3rd grade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, big picture.
Put in perspective. Yes.
Yeah. And I think bringing it back to the teachers too, and that reflection on the teachers, I think that sometimes, and especially with students who are very beginning levels of proficiency, sometimes the teachers may feel more frightened than the students.
For sure.
So that also, I think, links back to that mindset and thinking about ways that we can be intentional in our planning to, you know, challenge students cognitively, but reducing the language demands. So, you know, I think that's something that takes a shift in thinking. And if you've taught a certain way for a lot of years, it may take a little bit more time. But, you know, the English proficiency is not a measure of IQ or cognitive ability. And I think sometimes that gets a little bit confused. And I think links back to that pobrecito, like, I've got to take care of this kid. So.
Yeah, kind of wrapping up this part of the conversation. You know, we're talking about individual journeys. We're talking about recognizing different learning styles. We're talking about different, basically, educational and life journeys that people have. Everybody from pre-kinder, who we talked about, to Yvonne, your husband, who had an interesting experience at school. This is a life journey. And the experiences along the way can really affect people, as you laid out. So my question here, and what a lot of us, I think, struggle with is, how do we know when we've pushed too far, right? Productive struggle is, you know, is good. I mean, we want to be able, particularly for students who may be struggling with the language, but they have certainly a tremendous amount of other assets, there is going to be struggle with the language. And that is the key to open up the content, right? So how do we know when it becomes just a struggle and then it has more negative than positive consequences? That's not something you can just measure with an assessment. How do you do that?
I feel like I'll jump in. That's all right.
Yeah,
I think
of course.
So much of that has to do with building relationships with students and really getting to know them. I know that we talk about how important relationships are, but they, you know, giving students space to feel comfortable in sharing with you when you have pushed them too far. And that was always my kind of thing. You could sometimes see it on students' faces where they, you know, had this expression where they just wanted to give up. But I think giving them that voice and helping them learn how to advocate for themselves.
Yeah, again, back to the self-advocacy. Yep.
Exactly.
That is the direction I was going, is revisiting that self-advocacy. But it has to be where the teachers have created that safe space. And it is a skill that I think is missing. If you were to ask a student, how do you learn best? Or if you would say, can you communicate with me if you're feeling frustrated? I don't think we have enough conversations of the value of giving students that ability to self-advocate, because we need that in order for students to share that. As adults, Amy can come in and say, I have too much on my plate. I need some time, or I can't take on this new project.
Well, and good for Amy, by the way, who's an adult, because I know a lot of adults, including myself sometimes, who have a hard time doing that. So Amy, great, you've cracked the code. I could probably learn a lot from you, and so could many others. Sorry to interrupt, Devon. But it's not just a student problem. It's like, this is a people problem, right?
It is. And that's why you need people in your circle, and in this case, teachers, to help guide that and to say, you know, I need that. I am not like Amy. I will just take on a lot and just have too much. And I need someone to say, hey, you know, you need to look at what you're doing and look at your time management. So I think there is power for teachers to help guide students to where they are productively struggling versus frustration. And that's the conversation that we need to have. And it has to happen in a safe space and early in the year so that students start to acquire that voice.
Yeah. You know, over 15 years into my teaching career, right before I came to Elevation, I had this really unique opportunity to go and get also a second master's degree at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. And the degree was in technology, innovation, and education, a master of education.
Nice.
And I heard this term metacognition, right, when I was there. You're nodding your heads. I had never heard that term in my entire teaching career. I knew what it was. I knew that it was understanding how you learn and being able to sort of express that. But that, what you're talking about with like the self-awareness and self-advocacy and metacognition, is like this ability to kind of, I think this could be a whole other topic for another time, another episode, but this idea of bridging research and practice, right? We have these terms. We have these studies, we have this research that defines the things that we're talking about right now. But oftentimes, myself as a teacher, you know, I was going off of sort of the data that I was seeing in front of me, and I was reacting to all that. And it would have helped me a lot if I understood. I don't need to, like, nobody needs to take a vocabulary test and write the definition of metacognition, but to understand this is a part of what we're trying to do. And I think, by the way, that also cracks the code a little bit on the difficulty that sometimes we have with content teachers only wanting to be teachers of content and not being a language teacher. Well, if you understand what metacognition is and self-advocacy, now language becomes a key part of what you're doing, right? So I didn't ask a question there, but I welcome any reactions.
I think that's fascinating to hear. I think that Yvonne and I actually had a conversation the other day based on a TikTok video where this person was saying that they don't ever have interior conversations. That was strange to her, that people can't sleep at night because they're worrying about what they have to get up and do tomorrow. And Yvonne and I were like, what? We want that.
Internal monologue.
Yeah.
Internal monologue. Yeah.
And so I think that's so important to learning, and that we're monitoring that, you know, as we're going along. But I think it's a skill that needs to be explicitly taught, you know, like those learning strategies for students, so that they do feel capable of doing that and kind of tracking how they're doing as they go. I think we talk about metacognition, but we also talk about metalinguistic awareness.
Yep.
So that they're also thinking about the language that they're using and the word choices that they're making, and kind of monitoring themselves that way as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lots of opportunities, I think, there for the teachers to model that.
Yeah. Yeah. Great point. And part of that is just understanding that we all have different skill sets and embracing failure, right? Not being afraid to make a mistake as a teacher is a part of that. And then tying that to, well, you know, this is the way that I learn and the way that I teach, and I could improve in these areas. Or I could, you know, use the skills of the people in the room, even the students, or particularly the students, to kind of fill in whatever gaps I have. And that's how we work in teams, ideally.
I also think it's really easy to fall into the trap of thinking that everybody thinks the same way I do.
Yes.
And everybody learns the same way I do, you know, and that's until you run into somebody that's like, no, I don't have an interior monologue, that you think like, oh, wow, that's different.
Yeah. Having a neuro sort of divergent or right. neurodiverse children also helps you with that quite a bit. I can tell you that for sure.
Right.
Okay. So zooming out a little more, we've talked a little bit about like this idea about what sort of, or we've hinted at the teacher's kind of mentality, the educator mentality is. And you just mentioned the idea of understanding that everybody learns differently. And I want to get into a little bit of the idea of implicit bias, which we've talked a lot about on this podcast. Talk a little bit about that and we all carry it with us. How can it sort of hijack our ability to help students reach their highest aspirations? Particularly, always on this podcast, we're talking specifically about multilingual learners, but I think it's worthwhile to talk about, you know, all students, because they're all in that journey together.
Yeah. Well, I'll jump in to start. I know Yvonne wants to share another great story that she has about that.
I'm a storyteller. I think
she is.
I'm right. All for it.
But I think the first step, and I think you said it too, is just acknowledging that we all carry this implicit bias. I think sometimes we like to pretend that we don't, because we think it labels us as racist or, you know, bigots in some way or another. But for me, at least, you know, I've done some reading and some work, and have my allies, you know, who I can who can count on to check me if I say something, you know, that comes out that illustrates that implicit bias. But I think a lot of it just has to do with monitoring my own thoughts and the way I think about things. You know, maybe taking a breath before I say something out loud and process it that way. I used to have a, you know, I know we talk about these things about a safe word or a safe phrase, you know, if you get into a difficult situation. But I used to have a group of friends, and our quick check-in to kind of like, hopefully sort of jokingly check each other, was like, did you just say that out loud? So I think that
I say,
that
it, did I just say that out loud?
Right. I think it takes a lot of work. I again think it can be a long-term process, like any sort of shifts in thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, all right, so Yvonne, I hear there's a story.
Everyone that knows me knows I'm all about the stories. I think it helps make connections, right? When you're talking specifics. And my favorite story when it comes to this idea of implicit bias, and I want to say that I don't think anybody's immune to it. That's why the first word implicit is such a powerful word. And I had many of them as a teacher that I could reflect on. But I used to talk to, when I present specifically to high school groups, I would often talk about the potential that they had in empowering their students, specifically language learners, because we already have these thoughts of we're not equal or the same because we're still trying to acquire language. And my sister was a year ahead of me, and her science teacher recognized that she was really good at science. And he decided to make her a student aide to help in the class instead of being in the class because she was that good. And I remember telling teachers, this teacher saw the potential to a point where I, as the sister, was like, I want to become a student aide. I need to really study and be as smart as my sister so that my teacher can recognize me and make me a student aide. And it would be a great story to tell high school teachers, just to be on the lookout of those students that had the ability to be recognized in that way. So then I went to my sister one day and I shared how, oh, I tell your story. And she said, what story is that? And as I shared it, she's like, Yvonne, that's not a good story. That's actually the extreme opposite. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, I wanted to be a neurologist. I wanted to explore science. If my teacher had recognized that I had the potential, he would have told me to sign up for AP courses or more advanced science. But instead, he made me a student aide because he probably thought that that was my potential. So his expectations and her potential did not match. And that is what we're trying to communicate with teachers, is how are we recognizing the potential versus our expectations of our students? And that's the difficult question to ask.
And if we're not acknowledging that implicit bias, we may be thinking that we're holding students to high expectations, but still not enabling them to achieve their full potential.
Yeah. Yeah. You just tied it all together. I mean, there's so much in that story that I'm just going to say, if you're interested in sort of diving deeper in, I would rewind a minute. Do you say rewind anymore? Go back a minute and listen to that again, because it's a great way to illustrate it. But I think, like, to go back to that teacher who had clearly good intentions, to the point where you, Yvonne, recognized that this teacher had good intentions and, wow, what an amazing thing that they did for my sister. And I wish I was had that opportunity. Implicit bias may have had a role in that. There were probably other pieces as well. So my question, I was going to ask, how do we rein in implicit bias that may lower expectations for students' potential? But I'll say, I don't think it's just implicit bias. So, like, how does that teacher, going back, what do they do to live up to your sister's potential rather than, I guess, prescribing their own expectations or potential to her?
I think it goes back to the student. I keep saying self-advocacy, but I feel like my sister was missing that ability to, in that moment, say, I really would love to be a student aide, but is there another class that would potentially help me? I feel it depends on the age, right? But something that even was missing for me, I was taught early not to talk back. And for me, talking back meant defending myself in certain situations, which is why my name was changed. And I have a completely different name from birth because I didn't advocate for myself. But I think there is this idea that our students, because they're acquiring English as a language and they can't communicate fully in English, that we forget that there needs to be that time and space for students to know that advocating for themselves is part of their journey. And how do we do that? And how do we
hard. That's hard because I'm thinking like, not to interrupt, but I'm thinking in my head, like the devil's advocate part of me is like, well, your sister didn't say that. She didn't advocate for herself. And that's not her fault. I'm not like trying to say it's her fault, but like what skills did she need before that to be able to do that? I don't have a great answer to that question because that's a systemic question, unless you happen to have, and a lot of people are lucky enough to have this, like one particular person in your life who's pushed you to do that, or maybe you're just that type of person. But if you don't have one of those things, like it needs to come from the system. And it's always hard to talk about systemic change. That's my observation. Again, no question.
That speaks to something you didn't mention, and it's part of it. That students are not referred for gifted and talented that are labeled ELs. So there is a bigger,
great point.
Bigger issue here.
We did actually an episode on that. I'll try to link to it. And it was one of the most interesting. I talk about my own implicit bias. It exposed me big time because I'm sure that there were situations where I could have referred multilingual learners to gifted and talented programs and did not. So really great point and interesting topic. Amy, it looked like you were going to say something.
Yeah, I was just going to say too, I think even at a, you know, I don't disagree with the systems issue, but I think at the classroom level too, to me, it always goes back to that relationship and building those relationships with students where they feel comfortable talking about their aspirations. Yeah, I think it's also culture bound sometimes too. You know, I think that gets at the idea that I was saying too, like we don't recognize what we don't know or we don't know what we don't know. We may not recognize that that's not culturally appropriate for students to advocate for themselves, but you know, giving them the idea that you're here now, here's the way we roll, and I want to help you, you know, be able to advocate for yourself, and because that's what we expect and that's what we're looking for. So
yeah, and that's empowering. And I don't disagree that classroom teachers have a huge impact there. I guess not to go too deep down this kind of rabbit hole here, but I guess when I said systemic, what I mean is like, you know, there are a lot of educators, a lot, who feel that they don't have time for that. Like, I don't have time to build the relationships the way that I want to because I have this standardized test or this thing I need to do. So how do we break down those barriers? How do we, like, create systems that allow for building and nurturing relationships? You know, that's kind of more what I'm getting. I don't expect us to have a solution there, but I totally agree with it is, like, it does happen in the classroom.
Yeah, I think it may take a good shift in the systems too, because I know teachers are always talking about pacing guides and I have to cover the curriculum, you know, and I heard somebody say something smart once about if you're just covering the curriculum, you're not allowing students to discover the curriculum. So.
Yeah, love that. Let's shift gears a little bit. We're talking a lot about, I don't think I've ever said qualitative so many times in one of these episodes, but we're talking a lot about this kind of qualitative data. We're talking about sort of feeling things out, relationship building. But certainly quantitative data has a big role here. Thinking about looking at hard data, particularly for multilingual learners, and then connecting that data to the relationships we need to develop to our students and families. I think sometimes those two things kind of exist in silos. The hard data we use for like assessment and like progress, but then the relationship stuff, it's kind of more fuzzy. So how do we blend those together to kind of accomplish what we're trying to accomplish here?
Sorry, I can jump in here. I think that it's interesting because I've done quite a bit of work with data analysis in my career and looking at that hard data and making choices for students, or we talk about this data-driven decisions. But I think it's when you start to think that data is are not necessarily as objective or as neutral as we think they are. Because if we think about quantitative data, we're thinking it's numbers. Numbers don't lie. You know, we can sort this, we can sort students by that. But we fail sometimes to think about what data am I looking at? What bias am I bringing in when I'm looking at this data? And how is that influencing the way I'm analyzing the data? So I think if we don't acknowledge that. Well, I just think that some of our expectations can come in when we're looking at data. I remember, you know, data when there were big data walls in the teacher's lounge, you know, and they had these little color-coded students, and they talked about bubble students and who's on the line between, you know, below grade level and on grade level and that sort of stuff. But they didn't think about the whole child, and they were using this quantitative data to make decisions about what kind of additional services students got without really thinking about the students themselves and what they really needed. And it gets back, I think, to that systems level approach where, you know, issues at the system level where this is the way we do it. This is the way we sort kids. This is the data we use, but we don't really think about the soft and maybe the more qualitative aspects of that quantitative data.
Yeah.
I think it goes back to implicit bias as well, because we have a family engagement session where we have a slide and we ask teachers, what would you recommend for the families of this student versus this student? And we included qualitative and quantitative data, and they had very different responses for both students, and it was the same student. And it was based on how we described the qualitative and quantitative data. One of them had like a total score. The other one had very specific scores in reading. And so we just wanted them to see how sometimes that comes into play when you're looking at data. And it's so important for us to like step back and consider removing the name so that we can really think about what is it that we're looking for and at.
Yeah,
I think it gets to another bias, which is confirmation bias. And that's sort of like, I'm looking at the data to satisfy a certain idea I have about what it's telling me. So,
yeah. By the way, I can't resist saying this, like that activity of knowing that people in the room are going to be surprised, probably not in a happy way, about what they've just done is really, really powerful and gets to that idea of productive struggle. But I've also been in situation, we're kind of going to the PD piece here, and you probably both have seen this before. I've been in situations where that's gone too far. Like you take that too far, and then it just becomes a struggle, and the teacher sort of disengaged. So like the teacher and educator and PD provider in me is kind of like saying, that's really good to do in the correct dosage, right? Yes. I can't tell you how many times I've been in a session where somebody with really good intentions is trying to make me feel empathy for a multilingual learner and decides they're going to do the session in whatever language that they have. But it goes on for so long. And then it's like, I'm exhausted and I now can't get anything out of this. When you started, it was really great. And I think that's a really good way to tie in like the PD that we sometimes as teachers don't appreciate to the teaching that we're delivering to our students and where the line is. Because again, we're all people. We all have a limit and a line. And how do you know, getting back to the point, when you've gone too far, relationships, understanding your audience, understanding your people. So couldn't resist making that connection.
No, that's it. And I appreciate you saying that, because I have also been in those scenarios, and that's why it's so important. The idea of building empathy, teachers, I feel, have a lot of empathy. And what we're trying to do in just giving an example is just the opportunity to think, right? Because you just want them, like the reaction is, wow.
Yep.
And then that's it. We don't want them to continue to feel what it is that we're trying to explain here. You've already understood this piece. And that's why it's important not to go too far. And I know that is the balance that is so important, because you do want them to have an opportunity to think, oh, this is interesting. I hadn't really processed what I just thought, versus to sit in it for hours. So I appreciate that you said that.
I also think, and connected to shifting mindsets, you know, that's a delicate balance in a professional learning setting, where I don't want to say, somebody says something and I need to react in a certain way to try to shift the way that they're thinking without making them feel defensive.
Yep.
And I think that's a really delicate balance there. I want them to think a little bit of, I want them to go like, oh, wow, I can't believe I just thought that or said that, you know, but without bringing up those defensive mechanisms
yeah.
that shut people down and shut down the learning.
Yep. And that can happen in so many different ways. I won't get into them all because we'll be here for another 2 hours, but I'm glad I went down that path. So I want to kind of wrap this up with one other topic. And I bet you people are, if they're looking at the title of this episode and it's something about expectations and potential, there's been a thread throughout this conversation that we've kind of talked about that. But I bet you there are some people thinking that there are students, maybe they have students who, for a variety of reasons, don't feel that they have potential, or they have very low expectations for themselves. We can all, unfortunately, picture students like that. Perhaps we are working with one or two or five right now. So when students like that have those sort of challenges come into our classrooms, what are the first things we should be doing to help them sort of break that pattern? Because if they're stuck in that pattern, you know, we can't really do anything, right?
Yeah, and I think that's the most difficult, because there's such a variety of reasons behind why they may be feeling that way. If you go back to that example of the wood puzzle that I was having my family do at Christmas, I know for a fact that if I were to ask my husband what he felt he could be successful in and what he wanted as the potential reward for it, that it would shift his conversations. So I think we need to find out what it is that has caused that, right? Mm-hmm. Is it because, like, my son had an IEP? Is it because of his IEP and the conversations we had around his disability? Or is it my husband who struggled in general with reading? And was it that experience that caused him to feel this way? Because we have to, within our control, be able to identify what could be potentially creating this with students. I often say, and I said it to my students that I work with when I was in middle school, is it's almost like a marathon, right? I can run the marathon, not as fast as somebody that trains, but I can complete it. And the same message is, if I had the training, the time, and the experience, I could also run it as fast as the person that's running it. Mm-hmm. So how are we communicating that to students back to that individual journey? Because everybody has that journey, and everybody moves at a different pace and has different visions for their future. And we need to find a way to communicate that so that they don't fall trapped to the fixed mindset, right? There was a big initiative on a growth mindset, and I felt like that we were heading in the right direction, and then all of a sudden it stopped, and I don't hear about it much.
Yeah, you're right about that. Yeah, right about that.
That's the key. It's the growth mindset.
Yeah. And that's small but mighty yet, you know, and getting students to start thinking that way, that, you know, I'm on a path, I'm on a journey. I think even small things, I know I keep harping on relationships, but I think even small things like, you know, greeting students as they come in, especially at the secondary level where they're changing class periods, you know, and just like looking them in the eye, giving a big smile, I'm glad you're here. That, I think, over time can build the emotions in the student, or that sense that I do care about you, and that may help them break out of that cycle of feeling like they're not enough, or that they don't have aspirations that I, as a teacher, might help support them in meeting or achieving.
Yeah. And what that does is, if, you know, if some, and I saw this at the high schools that I worked at, I was a high school teacher, and, you know, that stuff's contagious. When one teacher sees another teacher do that outside in the hallway, they begin to do it. They begin to see sometimes they do it just because they see it and they say, I want to try that. But then if they don't and they see the results, they will, you know, and everybody's different. Like, you can't be someone you're not. I think with teaching, but which I think is a big mistake that some people make, but everybody can be sort of polite and sort of human and and make those connections, which I think is so, so important.
I think human is the key word there.
I was thinking about that. Like, this is, we talked about how multilingual learners, not, you know, a homogenous group, and there's groups within it, but really this all just zoom out, and this is a people issue, right? This is how we grow and how we establish school communities and, you know, wider communities and countries and everything else. So it's a really, I think, microcosm of kind of what's happening in the world. And if we want the world to be better, then we have to start where we're starting, which is no surprise to anybody listening to this right now. So
yeah, my aunt, who was an elementary teacher and who kind of got me into education, it's a second career for me. She used to say, you know, I can control only what those like 6 hours that kids are with me, but I want those to be the best 6 hours of their day. And I just, kind of gives me chills and brings tears to my eyes every time I think about that. But that, you know, had a huge impact on me. And I thought, I want to do that too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's wrap up with a couple questions that I ask everybody. You have a tremendous amount of resources. We have been talking, you and I and others from various groups that you're all in, about all these resources for a while. And so I want to give you an opportunity to let people know how they can learn more about the work you're doing.
Great. So Amy and I both work for a nonprofit organization called Wisconsin Center for Education Products and Services, and short is WICEPS. Not sure why it's WICEPS, but why is it WICEPS? It's
easier to say.
Yes.
Yeah. And so we have a variety of products and services that we provide for districts and schools, and we really believe in this idea of honoring teachers' voices and hearing from the teachers on what they need. And so we have a very customized care coaching program that really intends on having continuous support and not just a one and done. And so we've been working with a lot of districts in our care coaching product and our program for care coaching, but we do have a variety of others, and it is at wicepspathways.org, which I know you will tag, but anything you want to add to that, Amy?
Yeah, I was just going to say that part of what we do is professional learning. Other parts of it are different programs, and the connection with the University of Wisconsin at Madison and products that are created by professors there. So things like if people are familiar with DOK, Depth of Knowledge, that was created by Norman Webb as a professor at UW. And so there's a Webb Align and a variety of other products and services.
Great. And we will link to the WICEPS website as well as everything that you just mentioned, so folks can find that in the show notes and the blog, because there's a lot there. Okay, last question. And as I said before we recorded this, I told you to be ready. And this is a question that I ask kind of selfishly, but also because we do put a list out at the beginning of the summer every year about books that people should be reading, recommendations from our guests. So my question for you both is there a book, a film even, or another resource that's had an important influence on you? And I always ask, I always say either personally or professionally. Most people go professionally, but personally is fine too. It can be just an easy to beach read, whatever you want. So what would you recommend?
We didn't have an extra hour to share why I don't like to read, but
interesting. I'll share my favorite. That's another episode. Let's get into that.
That is a whole story. And so I'll share my favorite movie, and the movie that I think really caused me to think about education as a career, and that's Stand and Deliver.
I knew you were going to say that.
I'm telling you,
it's a classic.
This new generation teachers, when I mention it, they don't know it. It was from 1988, but Jaime Escalante and
Edward James Olmos.
Where the students are today, like, you need to Google where these students are today. Most powerful movie, and I think it speaks to everything that we just mentioned in this podcast, because he is the epitome of the type of teacher our students need.
Yeah.
That is my favorite.
Based on a true story, just to throw that in there.
Yep.
Yeah, I think another one that spoke to me was Precious, or it's just the issue of one teacher that was, you know, had a belief in what the student could do. And I just, on a completely different tangent, I would recommend a book called Teaching Language in Context, kind of completely separate from what we've been talking about a lot today, but it's talks about this functional approach to language, and it really opened my mind to how we teach students to write. So I think it's a great book.
Great.
And I want to just circle back to the Stand and Deliver, because there are two core messages from that movie, and it's how inspired students can achieve wonders if have teachers with high expectations, which we talked about, and Something Good for Even Math Education in the Latino Community, and how you could really inspire a lot of students that would not see themselves as mathematicians or scientists in the fields.
Great point. Yep. It is a wonderful movie. And Yvonne, I think you're probably one of only maybe three people who have taken me up on my offer to put a movie, a film out there. I always ask, and I've done like 250 or something of these. Wow. So I appreciate that. And we'll get into the reading thing another time. That's a bonus episode. You and I are going to sit down and get into that. Okay. Well, thank you both. This has been really, really a great conversation. I've been thinking about it for a long time because it's such a powerful message, I think. And I'm really happy with the conversation and how it went. I hope you are too. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations. If you liked our show, please be sure to join the ELL community at elevationeducation.com/ELL community, where you'll find all the episodes of Highest Aspirations and other resources to help educators maximize the impact on their English language learners. Also, let us know how we're doing by writing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.